This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran.
This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran's broadcasting. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily via the internet address www.parstoday.com/en. You can also listen to the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Intelsat 902, and Eutelsat satellite, as well as via internet. You can also listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for more details.
Here we enlighten you with ayahs 261 and 262 from the Surah Baqarah, recited by Ali Parhiskar.
A'udhu billahi minash shaytanir rajeem. Bismillahirrahmanirrahim. مَثَلُ الَّذِينَ يُنْفِقُونَ أَمْوَالَهُمْ فِي سَبِيلِ اللَّهِ كَمَثَلِ حَبَّةٍ أَنْبَتَتْ سَبْعَ سَنَابِلَ كَمَثَلِ حَبَّةٍ أَنْبَتَتْ سبع سنابل في كل سنبلة مئة حبة والله يضاعف لمن يشاء والله واسع عليم مثل الذين ينفقون أموالهم في سبيل الله كمثل حبة أنبتت سبع سنابل كمثل حبة أنبتت سبع سنابل في كل سنبلة مئة حبة والله يضاعف لمن يشاء والله واسع عليم الذين ينفقون أموالهم في سبيل الله ثم لا يتبعون لا يتبعون ما أنفقوا منا ولا أذى لهم أجرهم عند ربهم ولا خوف عليهم ولا هم يحزنون صدق الله العلي العظيم.
In the name of God, the most gracious, the most compassionate. The parable of those who spend their property in the way of Allah is as the parable of a grain growing 7 years, with 100 grains in every year. And Allah multiplies for whom He pleases, and Allah is ample giving, knowing. As for those who spend their property in the way of Allah, then do not follow what they have spent with reproach or injury. They shall have their reward from their Lord, and they shall have no fear, nor shall they grieve.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.
UN confirms a report that a top Saudi official made a death threat against the UN rapporteur in charge of a probe into the murder of journalist Jamal Khashoggi. North Korea fires 2 ballistic missiles into the sea near Japan just a few days after it launched 2 short-range missiles. Also ahead, the number of COVID-19 cases in the United States surpasses the 30 million mark, accounting for almost a quarter of the world's total caseload. It's good to have you with us. Our top story, the UN Human Rights Office confirms remarks by UN expert Agnes Callamard that she was threatened by the Saudis for her role in the Khashoggi investigation. Callamard said a colleague alerted her that a Saudi official had threatened to have her, quote, taken care of. The UN's special rapporteur on extrajudicial summary and arbitrary killings says the officials in the room had considered the remarks as a death threat. In a report published in June 2019, Callamard said Saudi journalist Jamal Khashoggi's death constituted an extrajudicial killing for which Saudi Arabia is responsible. U.S. intelligence reports also concluded that Saudi Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman approved and probably ordered the assassination of Khashoggi in the kingdom's Istanbul consulate in late 2018. Political commentator Lawrence Davison says the U.S. reaction to the Saudi threats against a top UN expert will not go beyond a verbal warning.
There'll be nothing from the U.S. State Department about this. At least nothing. Well, they might offer some verbiage about it, but there'll be no effective action. Okay? And this is because Saudi Arabia has these massive investments in the United States. So Saudi Arabia is in a position essentially to retaliate against the United States economically if they are pushed by Washington. And so essentially they're being blackmailed. Washington's being blackmailed by this. And that's how they get away with it.
Yemen has released footage of the moment when the army intercepted an intruding drone flying over the strategic province of Ma'rib. Yemeni forces shot down the unmanned aerial vehicle with a surface-to-air missile on Tuesday The drone was a sophisticated US-made MQ-9. It is not yet clear which country operated the drone. Over the past few weeks, Ma'rib has been the scene of large-scale operations. Yemeni army units and allied Ansar Allah forces are pushing against Saudi-led militants loyal to former President Abd Rabbuh Mansour Hadi. Several countries have reacted to North Korea's launch of two ballistic missiles into the sea near Japan. Members of South Korea's National Security Council expressed deep concern over the move. Japanese Prime Minister Yoshihide Suga called it a threat to his country and regional peace and stability, as well as a violation of UN resolutions. Tokyo said one of the missiles flew about 450 kilometers before landing outside Japan's exclusive economic zone. In a statement, the US military said the missile launches highlighted the threat Pyongyang poses to its neighbors and the international community. The statement added, the military is monitoring the situation. The launches came just days after American and South Korean officials confirmed the North's firing of two short-range cruise missiles. Jennifer Chang says North Korea wants the U.S. to roll back its hostile policy in order to engage in negotiations with Washington.
North Korea demonstrated that it can not only fire short-range cruise missiles that can hit any place in South Korea with tremendous accuracy, but now it's demonstrating that it can even fire a nuclear weapon all the way to Japan. And we are only a few months into the new Biden administration. This is going to be a tough problem for the Biden administration to tackle. But the North Korean first vice foreign minister, Choi Soon-sil, had warned on Thursday of last week that the U.S. has to roll back its hostile policy. Otherwise, the North will never engage in any type of contact or dialogue with Washington regarding its nuclear program. The Biden administration has reportedly been trying behind the scenes to get the North to the bargaining table. And this has been going on for months now. The Biden administration has been in office since January. So now the Biden administration is about to reveal its review of how it's going to conduct its North Korea policy. It's holding a security meeting with Japanese and South Korean officials in Washington next week, and it's going to reveal everything that it's found from its weeks-long North Korea policy review. It'll be interesting how today's ballistic missile launches will affect that North Korea policy review.
Now turning to other news, the United States has crossed the grim milestone of 30 million coronavirus infections as the country is grappling with a more contagious variant of the disease. More than 545,000 Americans have also lost their lives to the virus so far. That's according to data compiled by Johns Hopkins University. Cases are trending higher in 30 of 50 states compared to the previous week. This as several states have lifted mask mandates, with health officials now pinning their hopes on the vaccine rollout to prevent a rise in deaths and infections. In Latin America, Brazil's death toll passed the 300,000 mark amid an explosion of cases, making the country a global epicenter of COVID deaths. Over the past couple of days, Brazil has registered the highest daily death toll in the world. Elsewhere, Iran's ambassador to the United Nations says the U.S. can't advance its agendas by keeping oppressive sanctions on Tehran. Majid Takht Ravanchi said 2 months into U.S. President Joe Biden's term, Washington is still in violation of the Iran nuclear deal and the U.N. Security Council Resolution 2231 that enshrined it. He blamed Biden for pressing ahead with his predecessor's so-called maximum pressure campaign against Tehran while admitting its failure. Takht Ravanchi was responding to comments made by the U.S. Secretary of State. Antony Blinken once again asked Iran to take the first step to salvage the 2015 nuclear deal.
To return to France. While on a visit to Europe, U.S. Secretary of State Antony Blinken has been discussing the Iran nuclear deal, the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action, with senior EU officials.
I welcome the Secretary's reaffirmation that the U.S. is ready to engage and the prospects of a U.S. return to the JCPOA.
For his part, Blinken seemed only interested in spinning anti-Iran rhetoric following meetings at the European Commission Brussels.
We talked about our shared goal of preventing Iran from acquiring nuclear weapons.
Earlier at NATO headquarters in the Belgian capital, Blinken spoke at greater length on the subject.
To look at how we might come back to compliance with the JCPOA, we said yes, and to date, Iran has chosen not to engage. So, as we've said, the ball is really in their court.
Even Iran's harshest critics might find Blinken's position difficult to grasp. After all, it was the U.S. that withdrew from the agreement in 2018, at a time when Iran was in full compliance, according to the International Atomic Energy Agency. Many analysts believe Joe Biden's administration is bowing to pressure from Tel Aviv to not engage with Iran. It has been suggested, however, that Benjamin Netanyahu does not speak for everyone.
There's many parts of Israeli society and even in the authorities that believe this deal will be better for Israel in the short, medium, and even longer term.
The U.S. continues to impose illegal unilateral economic sanctions on Iran, despite the JCPOA having been underpinned by the United Nations. Tehran insists the current deal cannot be renegotiated, and the only fair and legal option for the U.S. is to rejoin the accord without preconditions. As the coordinator of the deal, legal experts say the ball is firmly in the EU's court and not Iran's. According to many analysts, Iran has demonstrated it is unwilling to remain in the JCPOA at all costs. Therefore, they say, the EU is clearly running out of time to save this landmark agreement. Jerome Hughes at the European Commission, Brussels.
And political commentator Nick Ayala says the fact that the Biden administration does not want to return to the Iran nuclear deal shows U.S. politicians, be it Democrats or Republicans alike, are not after cooperation with Iran.
Yeah, it's pretty amazing the hypocrisy of the Democratic Party, and not just the Democrats, but all of the politicians in the United States. Like you mentioned, at one point, a year ago, they were out there criticizing Donald Trump for pulling out of the JCPOA. Now they are, they ran a campaign really pushing for the renegotiation of the Iran nuclear deal. But what we're seeing now is what's interesting is now you have many Republicans, part of the GOP, as well as even some Democrats who are now calling on Joe Biden not to rejoin or not to renegotiate the JCPOA. And that's, that just goes to show that at the end of the day, it was never really about trying to find some sort of dialogue or cooperation between the U.S. and Iran for many of these politicians. What it was about was enacting U.S. imperialism and the fear that Donald Trump was not following or towing the line of U.S. imperialist policy. So now all these Democrats and even some conservatives went after him, attacking him, saying that he's not doing what you should be doing, what the established political operatives are already doing, following through with the deal. Rather, he's going against it. Now they want to go against it because they realize that, it's in their interest to be against any sort of collaborative efforts with Iran or any sort of dialogue.
Elsewhere, Palestinians say they don't believe Israel's parliamentary election would change the regime's antagonistic policy towards them. We discussed the matter with the guests in our news review segment. Let's take a listen to that.
And now Palestinian groups and factions are reacting to the results of Israel's general election, holding out little hope for change in the regime's policies.
The results of the Israeli Knesset election show once again the continuous shift in the social and political institutions of Israel toward the extreme right. This means the policy of denying the rights of our people, as well as the attempt to trample on these rights and an intention to increase the challenges facing Palestinian people.
Hazem Qasem called on Palestinians to adopt a united policy to confront increasing Israeli extremism. Palestinian political faction, the Fatah, said the issue of Palestine has not been on the agenda of the Israeli election and call for unity among Palestinians. Also, the Palestinian Prime Minister, Mohammad Shataya, said the future Israeli Prime Minister must end the occupation of Palestinian territories. He, however, expressed regret that Tel Aviv is shifting to the extreme right. The comments come as Israel has held a fourth general election in 2 years amid a spiraling political deadlock. Partial results show no clear path to victory for any Israeli parties. And now joining us for this news review is John Philpott, international lawyer at the ICC, joining us from Montreal, and Miko Pellet, author and peace activist, joining us from Washington, D.C. Gentlemen, I'd like to welcome you both to the program. I guess we will start there with John Philpott in Montreal. John, your initial thoughts on the Israeli elections and what Palestinians should respect as a result of it.
Well, I don't see it as any significant change. I'm not an expert on internal politics in Israel, but we know that the Labor Party and Gantz were terrible in 2014 in Gaza, and Israeli policy with respect to its neighbors has not changed, with respect to Iran has not changed. We see the region as, if anything, getting worse with the intensification of the American occupation of Syria, the war on Syria. I understand there's a new base going to be constructed in Jordan. So I don't see any shift in the politics of the region. We're aware of the conflicts with the shipping on the near Palestine, Israel. And so I don't see this as a big change. And it's up to the Palestinian political nation to decide on its future, but I don't see a change. From our end in Canada or in the West, we want to continue with BDS to allow the Palestinian people the right of return, equality, and the end to the occupation. And this is what I think is important.
Go ahead.
And some people are concerned about the shift to the extreme right. I'm not sure, with respect to the occupation, the center, the left, and the right are pretty much indistinguishable. And I would like to hear my colleague, who's going to be speaking in a few minutes, who knows internal politics of Israel better than me, and wonder whether it will be a change.
Thank you, John. And Miko Pellet, we have you on phone. I've learned. Welcome to the program. But your initial thoughts on the story.
Sure. These elections have nothing to do with change. It's just about the last four elections are part of Netanyahu's strategy to remain in power. It has nothing to do with change. I mean, it was obvious, I think, from the get-go that he was going to win. In the last election, there was a moment there where it seemed like he might actually have lost, that he was going to be unseated. But through his own political maneuvers and the weakness of the opposition parties, he was able to maneuver them to allow him to continue to be prime minister, and then actually go back on their word to the voters and the whole coalition that was built in order to defeat him fell apart. So he was able to do all of that in the last election. And in this election, there was no real threat to his seat. There was no real opposition to him. Everybody running against him are only doing so because they want a piece of the pie. They want to get a good portfolio. They know that they can't beat him. but they can perhaps negotiate a good seat at the table, and that's really what it's all about. It's only this is a strategy of the Tagal to remain in power. It has nothing to do with any kind of change. Now, it is true that there are certain elements on the right, on the extreme right, that have been strengthened, and we have to understand that while the majority of Israeli politics agrees on the issue of Palestine, that there should be no compromise, that the whole country belongs to Israel, and so forth, that Palestinians have no rights or space within that country, these particular elements that have just gotten stronger, their agenda is to destroy Al-Aqsa. Their agenda is to destroy the Dome of the Rock and build some kind of a temple there. So I think those elements have been strengthened, and I think the push to go in that direction, to get rid of more Palestinians out of Jerusalem, and eventually to get to a point where they have more control in Al-Aqsa and are able to destroy it and build their own kind of temple there, I think those elements have gotten stronger, and that is a very grave concern.
Thank you, gentlemen, both of you. John Pilpot, they're joining us from Montreal, and Miko Peled, they're joining us from Washington, D.C. And thank you for tuning in, and goodbye for now.
Brings an end to our bulletin for this hour. Thank you for staying tuned.
Was an IRIB English radio program. Please log on to our website www.parstoday.com/en.
Supplication on Thursdays. In the name of Allah, the All-Merciful, the All-Compassionate. Praise belongs to Allah, who has taken away the shadowy night by His power and brought the sight-giving day through His mercy. He has clothed me in its brightness and given me its favor. O Allah, just as Thou hast spared me for this day, so also spare me for its likes. Bless the Prophet Muhammad and his household, and torment me not in it and in other nights and days by allowing me to commit unlawful acts and to clothe myself in sins. Provide me with its good, the good of all within it, and the good of everything after it, and turn away from me its evil, the evil of all within it, and the evil of everything after it. O Allah, by the protective compact of Islam, I seek mediation with Thee, and by the inviolability of the Quran, I rely upon Thee. By Muhammad, the Chosen, Allah bless him and his household, I seek intercession with Thee, so recognize my protective compact, by which I hope my need will be granted. O most merciful of the merciful, O Allah, decree for me on Thursday 5 things, which none embraces but Thy generosity, and none supports but Thy favors. Health through which I may have the strength to obey Thee. worship by which I may deserve thy plentiful reward, plenty in my state through lawful provision, and that thou makest me secure in the places of fear through thy security, and placest me in thy fortress against the striking of worries and sorrows. Bless Muhammad and his household, and make my seeking his mediation as an intercessor give profit on the day of resurrection. Surely, thou art the most merciful of the merciful.
Nowruz Special. In the name of God, the Compassionate, the Merciful, Salam and welcome to the program. Today, the 5th of the Farvardin corresponds with the 11th of the Lunar Hijri month of Sha'ban, the birth anniversary of Imam Hussein's valorous son, Hazrat Ali Akbar, peace upon him. It is called the Day of Youth in Iran. Hazrat Ali Akbar was the role model of purity, manliness, and nobility. He was very handsome and virtuous. His father was the master of martyrs, Imam Hussein, peace upon him. And his mother was Lady Layla, granddaughter of the Urve bin Mas'ud Saghafi. Urve was the first among his clan to embrace Islam. Later, his own people martyred him because of believing in the Prophet of Islam. Congratulations on the auspicious birth anniversary of Hazrat Ali Akbar. Stay tuned, please. Ali Akbar was born in the house of Imamat in Medina on 11th of Sha'ban in the year 33 AH. He was brought up by Imam Hussein and his mother, Layla. His noble descent shaped the core of his character. Dr. Imadzadeh writes in his book on the life of this great personality, he has been described as the manifest epitome of valor, knowledge, merits, and the perfect mirror of the Prophet's morals and dignity. People of his time have also written on Ali Akbar. The behavior and disposition of Ali Akbar would revive the behavior of the Prophet in minds. Thus, it is no surprise to hear Imam Hussein, peace upon him, saying, whenever the Ahlul Bayt were missing the noble Prophet, they would look at Ali Akbar. Ali Akbar was so virtuous that even his worst enemies would admit his merits. Once Muawiyah, son of Abu Sufyan, asked his courtiers, "Who is the most qualified person to be the caliph of Muslims after me?" Each of them mentioned a name till Muawiyah himself said, "In my opinion, Ali, son of Hussein, is the most qualified as he has the valor of the Hashemites, is the descent of the Saqif, and has the generosity of the Umayyads." Of course, the Umayyads were not generous, and Muawiyah was telling a lie. و What is certain is that Ali Akbar was a perfect personality in purity, sincerity, chastity, modesty, generosity, piety, and good manners. The Ahlul Bayt were so absorbed by his virtues that on the day of Ashura, when he was departing for the battle, his sisters and aunts had excessively hard moments as they couldn't leave him. As he was going, Imam Hussein, peace upon him, said, "Dear son, walk slowly." Indeed, the Imam wanted to see him a little more. It was unbearable for Imam Hussein to depart from his beloved son. So he said, "My God, be witness that a youth is going toward this people who bears the most resemblance to your messenger in appearance, morals, and speech. Whenever we were eager to see the Prophet, we would look at him." The noted Iranian writer Sayyid Mehdi Shojai writes in his book Father, Son, and Love, "I think that the relation of Hussein with Ali Akbar was not merely the relation of a father with son. It was the relation of a gardener with the most beautiful flower of creation. Youth is like spring. Human being needs many things in the station of youth to be able to stand proudly and satisfactorily at the end of life. A young person needs progressive motives, lofty goals, and effort in acquisition of knowledge. He or she has the highest amount of potentials. He or she is the source of inexhaustible endeavor. Youth is the best period for building bond with God and shaping inward spirituality." Imam Sadiq, peace upon him, says, "When a young Muslim recites the Quran, it will be mixed with his flesh and blood, and Almighty God will place him among his high-ranked apostles, and God will be his defender on Judgment Day." Societies are dependent on youth, and having a young population is a great advantage. If these youth have necessary specializations in different fields, their society will march toward advancement. Youth always play a significant role in various issues in society. Thus, they should take care not to be entrapped by malicious currents and ideologies. Unfortunately, in many societies, great jobs and fateful plans are ceded to old people with the pretext of being experienced, while the old generation should act as advisor and not the engine of great enterprises. Prophet Muhammad, blessings of God upon him and his progeny, used to appreciate youth not just verbally but practically. For instance, after the bloodless conquest of Mecca, he appointed a 21-year-old youth as the governor of the city. He even told the elderly to obey him and pray behind him in congregational prayer, as he was the most qualified among them. He said, "Give place to the youth in assemblies and teach them new things, because they will replace you in new affairs." Imam Ali, peace upon him, also said, "When you need advice in a job, first refer to the youth, because they have a sharper mind and a faster thought. Then refer to the elderly to follow up, evaluate the result, and choose the best way, as they have more experiences."
Comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio.
European News Bulletin.
Hi there, my name's Amina Taylor, and we're broadcasting from the British capital. And it's in the UK where we begin, because as the country is about to ease the restrictions of its third lockdown, the vaccine rollout, they say, is going well, but how hard has the UK been hit by a year of on and off closures? And how shrewd have the government's rescue initiatives been? Well, some say when it comes to the economy, the worst is yet to come. Bianca Rahimi tells us more in the next report.
A moment of silence for more than 126,000 Britons who have died since the UK government announced the UK's first lockdown this time last year. And as the country prepares to exit its third, the government's handling of the crisis is being called into question. Some say the success of the vaccine rollout is being used to obscure just how unprepared the government was and how Britain has been made poorer by poor decision-making. Economists say the lowest income bracket will have to foot the bill, which may exceed £355 billion.
The taxpayer will put almost certainly most of it, and it's 355, but then you've got the next year's borrowing, which be another 234 and another 100 on top of that, getting up to 700-800 a billion. The key point about this is that the whole of their philosophy is based on the idea that the very wealthy will trickle down their wealth to the mass of the population. That never happens. The very rich cannot spend all their money, even if they wanted to, which they do not want to. But I'm afraid the repayment is going to be done simply by taxing the bulk of the population, including the poor.
The Public Accounts Committee said earlier this year the government's lack of economic planning and preparation for a pandemic was astonishing, despite it being one of the top risks identified in the National Risk Register. Billions have been thrown at businesses in danger of going under, and if the borrowers can't repay them, the taxpayer will.
They panic, and they are in a panic situation at the moment. They're just crossing their fingers and hoping it will go well, but they're still in panic mood, and that explains why they just shoved out the money. There's been a lot of fraud, most of it haven't had checks, but it's because they recognised how fundamentally weak the situation is. You see, it's more than the virus. It's what's there underneath. In the understanding of economics at this moment, there is no policy at all concerned with spreading the real economy to every individual in society. That it is what is needed. It does not form the slightest part of their present thinking.
There is no way of knowing how many fraudulent claims have been made, and it is forecast many businesses will not be able to repay their debt, so the British public will have to. Throughout the pandemic, the government reassured lenders who were not required to perform any credit or affordability checks by guaranteeing loans 100%. But that can't be said for the British public, that is already reeling from years of declining social mobility and a near decade of rising child poverty. Bianca Rahimi, London.
For his thoughts, Ranjit Brha, NHS doctor, consultant and surgeon, joins us. Mr. Brha, it's 1 year on from our first lockdown. How would you assess the trajectory we're on?
It's good to be with you. Thanks for having me. The entire handling of the pandemic has been a shambles. I think you quite rightly say the government are now resting upon the technology of vaccination and are playing that up as a great success of their overall management. But really, from the very beginning, we've had scandal after scandal, mismanagement after mismanagement, incompetence, but backed by that underlying economic thesis, as you just highlighted, that essentially it's the job of the working class to bail out the wealthy. We had the scandal regarding PPE, and we didn't essentially procure PPE for our frontline workers, and we've had over 900 health and social care workers die. We had scandals around ventilator scandals, inability to procure and manufacture enough equipment in the hospitals. We've had a huge amount of money essentially wasted and frittered away, $45 million on a testing scheme which was inadequate, because no support was given to the most economically marginalized section of the population who are unable to isolate, and therefore the virus was allowed to run rampant. And that was the avowed policy from the beginning, as enunciated by Dominic Cummings, that we would rely on herd immunity, protect the economy, and if a few pensioners die, so be it. They did allow it to run rampant throughout the population, and that was precisely the cause for so many deaths, such a high rate of deaths, really the greatest rate of deaths of any developed country, at almost 1,900 per million of the population. Despite that, they were unable to protect the economy because there was a fundamental weakness in the economy, which was that there's so many people in our country have become relatively poor and marginalized, they were unable to support demand in the economy. And we have seen an overall contraction of the economy over the entire year of 10%, meaning that really we are in an unprecedented period of economic decline, which does constitute an economic depression, not a recession, Amina.
Now, it seems the UK is trying to counterbalance that economically by lifting lockdown restrictions, opening up hospitality, and so on in the coming weeks. This, conversely, as Germany, Italy, and France, and so on, prepare to go a different direction. Briefly, Mr. Bra, is the UK government being a little naive here?
Probably not, actually, in this instance. The only thing that we have done correctly is being able to roll out vaccinations on a mass scale. The fact that 40% of our population have now been vaccinated, the fact that the most vulnerable sections of the population who we know have the highest rates of death from COVID have been vaccinated, does mean that we're very unlikely to see an increase in the rates of death. We still have people lingering in hospital. Still 7 or 8% of our beds are taken up by COVID patients, but increasingly, as the elderly and vulnerable have been vaccinated, we wouldn't expect to see the same number of deaths. Conversely, in the EU, we're talking about 5 to 10% of the population vaccinated, and that's why they are currently experiencing a very large third wave, and probably they would not be in a position to do what we are doing right now, which is not to say that overall the handling of this pandemic has been a success. We had a game plan, Operation Cygnus, in 2016, which showed we were inadequately prepared, precisely to keep on a trajectory of privatization and diminution of the NHS, which has been persistently attacked throughout this pandemic. That report was ignored. The scandalous results of the handling of this pandemic are directly attributable to lack of preparation, which was an ideological choice based upon increased profits and decreased provision, which would help to privatise the NHS. Amina.
Indeed. Thank you, Ranjit Bra, as always. Now, staying here in the UK, because the country's Home Secretary, Priti Patel, has defended her new immigration plans, which the British Red Cross described as inhumane. Patel says the current system plays into the hands of criminals and smugglers bringing people across the English Channel from Europe. Now, if negotiations with the EU are successful, Patel's plans will see migrants who arrive in the UK by illegal routes liable for removal, even if they are granted asylum.
EU countries also have a moral duty and a responsibility to be part of this solution. And today I'll be at the G6 talking about this very issue and making the case for reform of asylum and absolutely sticking to the principle of claiming asylum in the first safe country, because currently that is not taking place. We all have a moral duty and responsibility to save lives and stop people smuggling, and this is a collective endeavour where we must all step up.
The UK is promising new and improved resettlement routes and indefinite leave to remain immediately upon arrival for migrants who use the new system. French President Emmanuel Macron has announced that his country will be reopening its embassy in the Libyan capital, Tripoli, as a gesture of support to the country's interim government. During a speech, Macron added that he has hopes that foreign forces working in the conflict-stricken zone leave as soon as possible. Libya was thrust into chaos in 2011 after a NATO-backed coup led to the dismantling and the murder of Muammar Gaddafi. Earlier this month, the country's UN-backed interim government, headed by Abdelhamid Dbeibah, took power. Now, Dbeibah and his proposed unity government will serve in their post until the parliamentary elections are held in the country on the 24th of December this year. Now, France's president has been I beg your pardon, France's president has been very busy, this time warning Turkey against any attempts to interfere in his country's presidential elections in 2022. He says Ankara has threatened to do so in writing. Now, this comes after a period of relative calm ties between the two nations. Macron has accused media controlled by Turkey and Qatar of spreading lies, alluding to their recent coverage of Islamophobia in France. Disagreements regarding conflicts in Nagorno-Karabakh, Libya, Syria are also taking their toll on relations between Paris and Ankara.
This is European News Bulletin broadcast by IRIB English Radio. In this program, we covered the most recent developments all over Europe. You can listen to this program on Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday, and Saturday.
The CIA's links with a man described as the Bin Laden of the internet now revealed, and in devastating telecolor. Isn't that right, Ahmed Caballo?
Yeah, I mean, there's been much made of Al-Qaeda's links to the US government and how in many ways it's been a Frankenstein monster that the US felt that they could control, but in the end always comes back to bite them. And this story is no different. So this report, based on the Yemeni government, the Honest of Allah Houthi government, has released a audio in which it describes the second longest serving CIA director, George Tenet, speaking to the then Yemeni president, Ali Abdullah Saleh, begging him and pleading with him to release a terrorist who was associated with the USS Cole attack in October 2000, in which 17 were left dead and 37 left injured. And what's worrying about this recording is in the recording, Saleh is at least asking for him to be released to the FBI. The CIA director, George Tenet, is saying, no, leave the FBI out of this and let's keep this between us and leave it as a personal favor. Now, could you imagine someone from Yemen contacting the US, asking them to release the terrorist? The US would tell them to get lost. But such is the role of the US and how it sees its extrajudicial sovereignty over all people in all lands, it feels so comfortable to make this phone call. So let's play that audio.
My responsibility, I talked to everybody in my government. I told them that I was going to make this call. I want to work with you, but I need this man released in the next 48 hours. This is my very personal appeal to you.
Right, if you just give me two of your favorite tweets here, Ahmed.
So the author of this article, Alex Rubenstein, says, new leaks reveal Anwar al-Awlaki, the Bin Laden of the internet, was a CIA asset as far back as 2000 when Al-Qaeda bombed the USS Cole. I document his assistance to the 9/11 hijackers and profile the life of the extremist imam liquidated by Obama in 2010. Now, he was seen as the spiritual leader to several of the 9/11 hijackers. Syrian Girl says, in a secret phone call, CIA Director George Tenet asked Yemeni President Saleh to release Al-Qaeda Anwar al-Awlaki from prison. Saleh suggests handing him over to the FBI. Instead, Tenet insists al-Awlaki be released and the FBI not be told about it.
All right, we move on to your second story. Some disturbing, some might say renewed or slightly different use of gameplay here from the United States.
Yeah, so there's going to be a new game release called 6 Days in Fallujah. And it's very worrying because for many people that followed the US-led war and occupation of Iraq, some of the gravest crimes were committed in Fallujah, where children to this day are still born with birth defects. Yet, in the eyes of these gamers, this just makes a perfect scene for a video game where people get to shoot Iraqis in their own country. Now, why this is so controversial is former US veterans are involved in the game to make it more realistic. Again, this is a place where many believe real war crimes happen, where depleted uranium was dropped, where white phosphorus was dropped, where, as I mentioned, children to this day are still born with birth defects, and yet the US has not been held accountable. Australia has not been held accountable. The UK has not been held accountable for their crimes. Instead, in many ways, they celebrate it by reenacting it, and by American citizens and video gamers around the world being able to reenact these scenes as if it's something to be proud of. Marwa Usman, the Press TV presenter, says this: do you know why the American society is so sick? Check out the tweet below. A video game based on an actual military campaign in which the US used white phosphorus and depleted uranium that resulted in the killing of over 1 million Iraqi civilians. The final tweet by Richard, he says, and meanwhile, instead of rotting in jail or swinging on the rope where he belongs, the butcher general, Rwanda campaign, and Najaf and Samara, Jim Molan, is now a senator in Australia's federal government. Now, obviously, this speaks to the point of the lack of accountability for those crimes because they were committed in Iraq.
Of course, it's always okay when it's done somewhere else. Thank you very much, Ahmed Caballo. Now, two Yemeni men have taken their case to Germany's highest court, demanding that the country must prohibit the U.S. from carrying out international drone attacks from Germany's air bases. The duo Ahmed and Khalid bin Ali Jaber also want to force the German government to admit shared responsibility alongside the United States for the alleged killing of their two family members by drone strikes on Yemen back in 2012. Now, the family have argued that the U.S. airbase ban would help to protect them from any further attacks. The United States has so far not acknowledged the strike or the legal action. Israelis have voted for the fourth time in 2 years as Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu continues to cling on. But what exactly does this election mean for the Palestinians? Murtaza Jaffa has more.
Exit polls are in. Israelis have voted once again, but results indicate yet more political deadlock. Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu secured the most seats, but still remains a long way off a majority. In second place, Yair Lapid, of the centrist Yesh Atid party, who took second place with 17 parliamentary seats. He leads a coalition hoping to end the leadership of Benjamin Netanyahu. However, right-leaning parties that side with the Prime Minister's politics have gained more seats. The question now is whether they can form a working coalition. For many, that comes down to this man, Naftali Bennett, the leader of extreme right-wing Yamina Party, which backs the annexation of the West Bank.
I am determined to advance the values of the right wing. I will only act under one guiding principle, and that is what is good for Israel.
His seven seats may prove vital, as polls give Netanyahu's coalition of ultra-Orthodox and far-right allies between 53 and 54 seats. Bennett's votes could give Netanyahu the majority he needs, but the two leaders have been at loggerheads since 2018.
I think that there is a very clear message that the right wing has principles has won. There is a vast majority for that. And I'm happy that at least with that we'll have kind of a clear pathway. And the politicians, of course, will have to find some common denominator how to overcome their personal egos and go ahead with that.
While personal egos and political differences vary, policies towards the Palestinians remained very much a secondary non-issue throughout the campaign. A worrying development after the disintegration of the Arab Joint List Party following the last election. In fact, the day before the vote, Palestinian Prime Minister Mohammed Shtayyeh described the election as an internal matter for Israelis. In Gaza, Hazem Qasem, a spokesman for Hamas, said the Israeli election seemed to be taking place between the right and the extreme right. It's therefore no surprise that Arab voter turnout remained significantly low. This sets a worrying precedent for Palestinians living in the West Bank and Gaza. With a lack of representation and a continued move to the right, policies that will enact more annexation and entrench apartheid will continue without opposition. Some believe this is in fact by design. Ignoring the issue adds to the slow normalization and gradual ethnic cleansing of the Palestinians from their territory.
It seems, Robert Carter, the best way you let people know about your humanitarian endeavors and the fact that you couldn't possibly have committed an assassination most heinous is to threaten the person who was looking into that heinous assassination. Please fill us in.
Yes, you're absolutely right, Amina. It's really telling, I think, of this Saudi regime that we have today, the fact that it just carries itself in this way and is allowed to do so. This, of course, is just the latest example. The UN Special Rapporteur, who's been investigating the crime committed against Saudi dissident journalist Jamal Khashoggi. Her name is Agnes Callamard. She has admitted to the British newspaper The Guardian that, yes, she did indeed receive a threat during a high-level meeting just last year. And when asked how her and her colleagues took the threat, she said, yes, it felt like a death threat to me. It's quite an astonishing story. The article goes on to admit that the official, who hasn't been named so far, the Saudi official, actually went on the phone and allegedly spoke to people who he claimed, well, yes, they were up for the job being, of course, potentially committing another assassination against an international diplomat. Now, this, of course, is totally astonishing, but not surprising. Saudi commits war crimes, genocide in Yemen. The way it's conducted itself in the region, it bullies and intimidates its neighbors, and if it doesn't get what it wants, it tries to bribe or indeed commit crimes in order to get its own way. This, of course, has been condemned on social media. We can bring up some tweets now on the topic. The first one I have is from a critic, an Arab critic of the Saudi regime, Meriam, who says, complete solidarity with Agnes. This is what happens when there's a lack of accountability, particularly against genocidal regimes like the Saudi one. I'll add that. And then the second tweet I have, let's bring that up now. It says, unbelievable. There should also be ramifications for Saudi Arabia. Why are we giving them a free pass? Very good question, I think.
Yeah, I might have some answers for that, but a different story for another day. And you move on to your second choice today, worrying developments in Sri Lanka, Robert.
Yes, absolutely. So the situation in Sri Lanka is going from bad to worse for its Muslim minority community. Already we've seen examples of discrimination against Muslims taking place in Sri Lanka. One of the most notable examples was the forced cremation of people who had passed away. Of course, Islam doesn't allow cremation. It's deeply upsetting for Muslims to have to see their children or their loved ones who may have passed away from COVID symptoms having to be cremated. It's just not Islamic and it's not acceptable in Islam, but Sri Lanka has been forcing it despite a lack of evidence to say that it does actually make a difference in preventing the COVID spread. But what's happening more recently is there's a burqa ban which is set to come in place. There's also planned closure of hundreds of religious schools in Sri Lanka, Islamic religious schools specifically, and this all feeds into the idea that there is persecution taking place against Muslims. Let's play out a little clip I have. It's from the Minister of Public Security in Sri Lanka. Let's see what he says on the ban.
This is an extremist sign that came about very recently, so we will definitely ban that. Furthermore, there are over 2,000 madrasa schools in our country. Both you or I can't start a school and teach students whatever we want.
All right, your favorite tweet on this one, Robert.
Absolutely. So Islamophobic comments, I believe, there from the minister, and this has been expressed in social media too. The first tweet, let's bring that up and see what was said. There is one here. It says, to be clear, people stood against the government's mandatory cremation policy because it was unspeakably cruel, discriminatory towards Muslims, and had no basis in science or fact. Opposing it was the right thing to do. And there is going to be more opposition and criticism of these new measures, Amina.
Thank you, Robert, and thank you so much for being with us. Until next time, take care.
in the limelight.
Social media companies have a responsibility to protect children and young people online, but building a separate version of their platforms is not the answer, says Jessica Corbett, writer of an article published under the heading Deeply Concerning. Critics decry Facebook plan to build Instagram for kids 12 and under. Stay tuned for more of Jessica Corbett's article. Parents, child advocates, and big technology critics are responding with alarm to BuzzFeed's news reporting that Instagram, a photo-focused social network owned by Facebook, is planning to make a version for children under the age of 13, who are officially barred from both platforms but often able to access them anyway. It is deeply concerning that Instagram, a platform known for a host of troubling privacy, commercial, and design practices that undermine adolescents' well-being, is now setting its sights on even younger children. Josh Golin, executive director of Campaign for a Commercial-Free Childhood, CCFC, told Common Dreams website by email. If Instagram wants to do something for younger children, Josh Golin added, it should focus on getting under-13s off of the platform entirely.